After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
It's not what goes into you that is going to change you or defile you. It's what you do with what goes into you. So you can take something that's poisonous and filled with tamas, etc., and that you can transform it into sattva.
Welcome to Living with Reality, a podcast featuring archived teachings and modern conversations with Dr. Robert Svoboda, brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. Living with Reality explores Ayurveda and other wisdom traditions of India, which Dr. Svoboda has been studying for nearly 50 years. For more information, please visit beherenownetwork.com/Dr. Svoboda. That's DRSVOBODA.
Hello, and welcome to Living with Reality. I'm Paula Crossfield, your host and Dr. Svoboda's business collaborator. Today, I have a very special episode for you featuring a conversation with Dr. Frederick Smith about Vimalananda, who so many of you have grown to know and love through Dr. Robert Svoboda's Agora books. This conversation is important because Fred Smith is one of the people who Dr. Robert Svoboda sat with in Vimalananda's presence, who knew Vimalananda for many years. And so having a conversation with Dr. Smith would be the perfect kind of conversation to get you to understand what it was like to be in his presence. And it is particularly notable because this month of December, we're in 2023. This is the 40-year anniversary of Vimalananda's death. So it is the perfect time to revisit some of these stories. And I want to tell you a little bit about Dr. Smith, who is a former professor at the University of Iowa. And he is particularly trained in the study of Sanskrit literature. He lived in India for 16 years. And he's written a book called The Self-Possessed, which is a study of possession in India, which I highly recommend. And I know that Dr. Svoboda also highly recommends if you're interested in the topic of possession. So Dr. Smith has a long history with India and continues to visit there a lot. And I think you'll enjoy these stories. I act as a sort of moderator here. But I will tell you that was only because the two of them didn't know where to start and they asked me to do that. But I hope that what I have to ask helps facilitate the conversation in a good way and that you take away some good gems from this conversation. And of course, as always, if you want to learn with Dr. Robert, he has many courses on various topics from Tantra to Ayurveda to Jyotisha to the different deities like Ganesha and Hanuman and different practices you can use to work with these deities. All of that is available at Dr. Svoboda, drsvoboda.teachable.com. You go to the products or courses up in the right-hand corner, open it up, and you'll see everything that is currently available for sale. And you can go in there and learn more from him. Okay, so without further ado, here is this week's episode of the podcast. Hello, Dr. Fred Smith and Dr. Svoboda. Welcome. We're going to talk a little bit today about your first encounters with Vimalananda, your experience with Vimalananda. So maybe we can start there with how you first met Vimalananda and how Fred first met Vimalananda.
Well, let me start with how I first met Fred, which was in Pune. I had just got there to be enrolled and study at the Ayurveda College, and Fred was doing his master's degree in Sanskrit at Deccan College in Pune. And we were introduced by our friend Nandu Kumar Gujar, who eventually became Swami Gopalananda. It was after we were introduced by him that we started hanging out together.
Yes, I also know that the person who taught philosophy at Pune University, who taught a class I was taking named Dr. Bhavisar, lived next door to Robert.
And was the Sanskrit teacher at the Ayurveda College.
Yes.
So there were connections there. And I met Vimalananda in September of 75, and you met him?
In maybe December of 79.
December of 79, and I introduced Fred to him. Fred had gone back to the U.S. and then came back to India.
Right.
So what first impressed you? I know you've talked a little bit about this, Dr. Robert, but maybe, Fred, you can share a little bit about what your first experience was like with Vimalananda, and you can share whatever insight you want to, too.
Shall I speak?
Please.
Well, when I was taken to Sri Vimalananda, and I had, in the interim, Ravi had come back to the U.S., and his parents were living in Farmington, New Mexico, which is not terribly far by New Mexico standards to Santa Fe. And
is your birthplace.
Which is my native place.
Your hometown.
My hometown. And we had gone up to the Rio Grande Gorge, just south of Taos, and we're sitting there, and he was telling me a lot about Vimalananda, and that gorge is a very amazing and sacred place by itself. And I thought, you know what? I need to meet Vimalananda. So when I got back to Pune towards the end of 1979, one of the first things we did was meet Sri Vimalananda. And my first meeting with him was at his apartment, at his abode. And we came in, and in this kind of dark corridor by the gate guardian, which was this kind of dissolute-looking youngish Parsi guy with a T-shirt and a pair of shorts. And I thought, This is pretty nice. It looks like an old Mughal court or something like that. And so we were ushered into the room, and Roshni was there, and Ravi, and there were these two small chairs, comfortable but small, just about a foot off the floor. And he was sitting in one, Vimalananda was, and there was this small Pekingese named Lizu sitting next to him. And I thought, wow, this is great. It's so informal. And informal, but he was a very commanding looking presence. His hair was always very neatly done, combed straight back. And his he had, as I recall, a purple regular Western style shirt on, and patterned. And there was a drink in his hand, a dog by his feet. And I thought, this is really different from any kind of, you know, spiritual sort of presence that I've been introduced to in India, because of course my background was quite mainstream, you know, where people would try to fit the expectations of Western clientele and so on, but there was none of that. So I was immediately relaxed, and we would sit on the floor, and, you know, a few people would file in here and there, and there might have been a half a dozen people there after a while, and Vimalananda was taking questions. He was intermittently smoking, petting his dog. The dog would be in the lap sometimes. And we had a very nice chat and introduced ourselves. I introduced myself and Kathy, and we did good. It was a nice, memorable, relaxed occasion. I thought, well, spirituality can come in all kinds of different sizes and shapes. And let's see how this goes.
So was it like a satsang where you're asking spiritual questions?
Oh, it could have been a bit of a satsang. People were always asking him questions. But
many of them would ask questions more about, is my truck going to be able to make it up the hill with the over, now that it's overloaded, please help me out, kind of thing.
Exactly. This is the kind of question that most people want to know. People go to somebody with spiritual reputation, and a person is expected to be a siddha of some kind or another. And in this case, they were right. And a siddha means somebody who was able to say and do things that were unusually prescient, let's say. And people were asking questions like that. They always come to these people. I want to know, you know, is my grandmother going to survive? Is my daughter going to find a good match? Is my son, I haven't heard from him for a year. He's been in North India, and how is he doing? This kind of thing. This is what people want to know. And there's nothing wrong with that. And because they're not asking spiritual questions about the nature of the self, should not be considered to be a non-spiritual question.
No, Vimalananda was always happy when people would ask spiritual questions, because otherwise it was always the same kind of run-of-the-mill thing.
Yeah.
So what did you witness there that made you want to return, or that intrigued you, besides the environment? Like, what was it about his energy, or was there something that he said to you, or was there a connection forged?
Well, there were two things. One is, I had been already good friends with Dr. Robbie here. And the second thing was his eyes. Okay. His eyes were such as I had not seen before. And I couldn't quite tell what the color was in that evening light, Bombay light, in a room that never gets direct sunlight. And I couldn't tell if they were blue or gray or green or what. And he was very expressive. His face, his demeanor, his body language, he was the most beautifully expressive person maybe that I had ever met in that way. His big shoulders, his nice, smooth arms. He must have been getting towards the end of his life, about four years before he died. And he was a person whose very every movement was significant. And I began to learn then that from the very first meeting, that in order for me to understand what was going on with him, I had to really pay attention, because he was working on, and I was hardly familiar with working on different levels at once, but I could see immediately that he was doing things on levels in addition to simply addressing our needs and questions. And I thought, okay, I want to find out. I want to dig deeply into this.
The thing about his eye color, of course, is that it changed. And more than once, he and I would be together with some other people, and he would say, he would just adjust his eye color so that his and mine were the same. And sometimes he would adjust it to be the same as somebody else's eye color. That was quite, I've never seen that before.
What was the point of that, though? Was that to kind of connect with the person or engage in a certain way? Or what do you think the point was?
I think part of it was to have fun and connect with the person. He was always doing things to have fun, just to experiment and see what would happen. But I also suspect that alters somehow your perceptorium when you know, and that may have just been a sign of how he was aligning in some other way with that person. But yeah, he never talked about what he was doing. I mean, most of what he did, he never talked about. He talked about a lot, but I mean, that was still not the majority of what was going on.
In this way, he's very learned. He was one of the most learned people that one would meet. And in India, there's a lot of really learned people walking around whom you could meet. And of course, you know, we did meet such people. But he was very learned in a lot of sort of academic, in history and in philosophy and in spirituality and a lot of ways that I would connect with, given where I was at the time. And remember, that was 45 years ago, or 40, something like that, 43, 44 years ago. And, but then I would see flashes of him saying things and doing things that I knew that I didn't know what he was doing. And, but he was, you know, beautiful to listen to and to watch. And, you know, I had to drop pretensions, spiritual pretensions that we all had when we were young about, say, smoking or other sorts of things that we were
like, letting. You're not allowed to do those things.
Allowed to do these things. Yes. I mean,
and what was his perspective, just to put a finer point on it?
Well, I mean, his perspective was, it's not, and I think it's not what goes into you that is going to change you or defile you. It's what you do with what goes into you. So you can take something that's poisonous and filled with tamas, et cetera, and that you can transform it into sattva. I mean, he would say, for example, and this was back at a time when even in Bombay, many people were still cooking things on coal. And coal is very black and very dirty. And it takes a long time to get the coal started. Once it gets started, it is hard to put it out. So he would say, you know, tamas is like this coal. It's going to remain, it's going to pollute you, it's going to pollute things around you until you ignite it. And it's going to take a lot of, the more tamas you have, the more effort it's going to take to ignite it. But once it's ignited, that tamas is going to keep it burning. So if this is the direction in which you are supposed to go, according to your own personal dharma, and you work hard, then it will give you, it can give you a lot more momentum than if you're just doing very, very mild and sattvic and conventional spiritual practices.
We always watched what he was doing. For example, he would take us sometimes in Pune. He was in Pune for about 4 months of the year because the horse racing season for Bombay was in Pune, and during the rainy season, hot season, rainy season. And he would take us sometimes to a dinner place called the Hotel Dreamland. And the Dreamland was this very refined Gujarati thali that was endless. And they would serve you until you
rolled out.
You rolled out the door.
Or were carted out.
And everything there was extremely fine, extremely beautiful, extremely well done. And Vimalananda would encourage us to eat our fill, but you could see his eyes kind of narrowing when it got to certain dishes. And I thought, what's that about? And so I felt, he would be looking at this dish. And I thought, okay, I better not eat that. But on the whole, he was a person of very refined taste and knew where to get things that were very refined, but he knew what the limits were, even in a place like that. But, of course, Robert has been in plenty more of those places with him.
Maybe you can talk about some of the experiences that you've had, like shared experiences, stories. Talk about, you know, different situations you got yourself into and how you saw Vimalananda navigate. You want to start, Robert?
I think the thing to emphasize is that both of us, me particularly because I was his authorized racing agent, but, you know, both of us have experienced him in situations in which he made it a point not to let anyone know what his capabilities were. So just being out in the world at the race course or at the Dreamland Hotel or traveling around or whatever. It was always very instructive to watch how he was managing a situation, knowing that there was so much more to him than what he was displaying, and to see how that situation was being managed. And, you know, if he really lost his temper, then unusual things would happen.
That, like what?
Well, we were talking earlier. I wasn't there that time, but Fred was with him when they went to... There's this very unusual temple outside Pune near the city of Yavat called Buleshwar. It was a fortified tantric monastery. And it's unusual in many ways, but we used to go there, and I used to go there and do a certain thing to find out whether one of his horses would win or not.
Which is in Agora 3, for people who are listening.
And so there, once Fred had gone there with Dr. Banotra, who is a kind of Ayurvedic doctor from Bombay. I'm a very prominent and affluent doctor, but please...
Yes, so Dr. Panotra and I went there with Vimalananda always a trip to Buleshwar was really worth it. It's about 35 kilometers from Pune, southeast of Pune, towards Sholapur, which means towards Hyderabad, that direction. And it's up on a mountain, or a big hill. It's very prominent. You can see from the road several kilometers away that there's a temple up there, but almost nobody would go up there because it was really prominent in maybe the 500 years ago. It's really an old temple. And with all of this incredible imagery, both with like a lot of reliefs from Mahabharata, from Ramayana, from tantric sources, all of these, I mean, it's one of a kind in that whole area. And it was a very powerful place, and Vimalananda had the capacity to kind of enliven the tantric forces at that place, to go in there with him. And by the time I knew him, he was already pushing up there in years, and for him to even walk up there from the parking was a little bit of an effort. And Dr. Panotra, I mean, unbelievably, it was Dr. Panotra actually ran out of gas, something which absolutely he should not have done. And the late Vimalananda was not happy about this. And because there we were stranded on the top of this place, you know, 35 kilometers from Pune. And...
And back then, there was nothing there. There's more stuff around it now. So there you were. No one was around. There's nothing there. What are we going to do?
Yeah, so Mr. Vimalananda, he reminded us of the story of a certain tantric whom he'd met who could piss into the gas tank and the car would go for another 100 kilometers. And we thought, is he going to do that now? And he did not. But he beat on the gas tank a few times, on the, you know, or fill it up. Just he was pissed off. He beat on it a few times.
With his fist?
With his fist. And it got us back to Pune.
Oh, well, there you and, go.
or at least to the next petrol pump, which close to Pune. So, but he let Dr. Banotra know exactly
how he felt.
The species of four-legged animal that he had descended from. and
so you're saying he had a temper.
He had
a
temper.
He wasn't afraid to show it also.
He was not at all not afraid at all. To show his temper. No, it's not like he was sitting on some dais and Hari Om Mataji kind of thing. No.
Right.
Well, he said he wasn't a guru for, I don't know, for that reason.
He never said he was a guru. He always said he wanted to learn more and more. And, but I, you know, at least a couple of other times, I remember that we were out in the car and something went wrong with the car. And he said, let's, you know, once he said, you better pray to Hanuman now because otherwise we're not going to get back. So we prayed to Hanuman and the car went back, you know. So I actually remember another incident that involved Dr. Banotra. You know, the thing with him was he was interested in dealing with his runanubandhanas, his yes. karmic debts. And that meant even if there were useless people hanging around, he would let them hang around as long as he felt that there was some karmic debt there. As soon as he felt like that was finished, he would kick them out or they would automatically not return or something else would happen. So he found Dr. Banotra vaguely amusing. And
you're saying Vimalananda was most concerned with that, so yes. he would let people hang around.
Yes. Okay. So Vimalananda found Dr. Banotra modestly amusing, and he did make some decent medicine. So he would let Banotra hang around because he was delivering the medicine also. But this also required him to, you know, to deal with situations that where, you know, he was making sure that because he wanted to continue working out his karmas with Dr. Banotra, that he, you know, for example, had to keep him alive. So often we would go to, on Mahashivaratri, we'd go to some temple somewhere. So one Mahashivaratri, we were all going to a temple of Shiva outside Alandi, which is outside of Pune. And Fred and Vimalananda and somebody else were in one vehicle, and I and Dr. Banotra and his daughter were in another vehicle. And Dr. Banotra was very fond of high-end sweets. And so we had, I don't know, 5 kilos of sweets or something with us. In the back behind, the two of them were sitting in the car, and they were back behind them, you know, so kind of where their heads were next to the back windshield. And it's I'll condense the story, but the driver of the car made an unfortunate remark to a group of people who were standing by the side of the road who were upset about an accident that had just happened. And that set these people off and they decided they were gonna beat us up or kill us. And—
Which is not unusual in India.
It's not overly unusual, but we were speeding down the road with no windshield left, and I had a few drops of blood from one cut on my ankle. Dr. Banotra and his daughter were covered in blood. Fortunately, they weren't damaged severely because a rock, the size of a watermelon had come through the back windshield, but intersected with all of the sweets and therefore saved them somehow. Mm-hmm. And I then remembered that there was a police station on the road, and we went and hid behind the police and were saved that way. And Vimalananda, of course, pretended he didn't know what was going on because he was in the car behind us. But it I always felt like there was some kind of influence happening from him and possibly from much later. In fact, just very recently, I discovered that there is the head of an English soldier who was killed 200 years ago that is being worshipped in that police station. So I always wondered if somehow, because he was always dealing with spirits and dead things and what have you, if he just said to that head, you know, okay, make sure that that the car in front of us is properly taken care of and something good will happen to you. Mm-hmm. I don't know that happened, but it was a weird enough as it was, but then to have gone to the one police station, possibly in the whole state of Maharashtra, that has the head of a deceased English soldier in it that's being worshipped, it just seemed a little bit too coincidental to be coincidental.
In fact, this brings up the whole topic of spirits, which was a very big subject for Vimalananda, which he imparted a little bit of his vast knowledge to us. And oftentimes he did this in very offhand ways. He wasn't the kind of a person who would sit there and give a lecture. He would answer questions. He liked to tell stories. But he was not a person who would sit there and use notes to give a philosophical lecture. But we learned a lot about spirits from him. And because that became a prominent part of my own like academic research, in which ways I've been involved with spirits as outside of the academic research, as we all have, as I believe we all have, and as I'm sure that Vimalananda was perfectly aware too. And this is how I got that from him. And maybe, and I'm sure Ravi also, but he was attuned to what we would call the Adidaivika realm, the celestial realm, the realm of gods and spirits and that kind of thing. You can say there's three realms. There's the Adidaivik, there's the Adibhautik, which is the terrestrial, and the Adhyatmik, that which deals with the self. And almost all spirituality in India is formally Adhyatmik, which means deals with meditation and that level, especially spirituality, which is designed for non-Indians. But there's a lot in India, as we've both discovered, that is really the Adidaivik level, and he was very attuned to that. He was very attuned to the mechanics of forces around us that are always there, in my view. I believe I picked up a lot of that from him. And I'm sure that Ravi would say the same thing. But to be aware of cosmic forces, whether they were, you could call them deities or call them forces or call them whatever you want to call them. But he was always aware that there were other things at work. And one of the places where he taught us where they existed were in trees. And you can talk about trees.
Mm-hmm. I can. You know, he would have favorite trees, particularly, and he would point certain trees out and say that there's something interesting living in that tree. And sometimes he would say, never go too near that tree because the thing that's in it is almost like a rabid dog. You can't reason with it at the moment. And there was a tree outside Pune in the locality called Ond, which is near where the University of Pune is. And periodically, we would visit some people who lived in Lula Nagar, which is near Ond. And when we were coming back into Pune for the night, we would stop at this tree and he would offer it some incense and he would stand and talk to it for a while and then we'd proceed ahead. And he would never say what he was doing, but he could have been doing anything because, you know, and with regard, sometimes he would ask a tree to benefit somebody. Sometimes he would ask or whatever was in the tree to keep an eye on somebody. So he always tried to keep good relations with all of the embodied beings and the disembodied beings and tried to get as much collaboration and cooperation as possible. And sometimes this was possible and sometimes it was not possible. And sometimes he had to deal with disembodied things and embodied beings in a severe kind of way. And sometimes he didn't have to. I mean, it was just like there was always this, every situation ended up being in some way original and non-standard.
How do you think he helped the two of you get connected to that Adi Daivik realm? Like what, how did that transfer for you?
I think just being around him and observing and becoming sensitized to the fact that he was doing it, I think sensitized us to it as well. And those, I'm sure there's others who were equally sensitized, but we certainly were, because we were always aware that he was working on levels that we could not be, about which we could not be fully cognizant, but we could tune in to some extent. And through that tuning in, we developed our own, I should say fairly modest, at least in my case, skills at observing such things. And you could observe it not just because of some inner psychic, you know, divya drishti or inner vision, but because of seeing the way that things were on the outside. You could watch things on the outside and understand that there were certain other kinds of intelligences or substantialities or presences that were at work. And then you'd think about it and look at things, literally look at things with your eyes in a different way. And it's learned. It's something that could be picked up. I mean, maybe there's some propensity for it, but in any case, it is, I mean, this was a way that he was teaching by just sensitizing us to use our own senses, really.
What role does HOMA play?
But before I go to that, I'd like to make two comments. Number one is, it is really a matter of looking at the same, you know, using your, and not just your physical eye, but the faculty of vision in a more subtle way, but looking at what you normally look at in a conventional way, one that's been, you know, evolved over millions and hundreds of millions of years, but looking at things in a slightly different way. Sometimes if I need to do that, I have a book that I don't even know what they call it now, but it's like two-dimensional flat thing. And if you change the way you look at it, you will see that it appears to be three-dimensional. And that's really a similar kind of thing, except not using your physical eye, but you're just kind of readjusting the way you're looking at reality, and then suddenly you can see other things, number one. And number two, as Fred was saying, I think one thing that is characteristic that I found to be true when I'm doing yoga with somebody who is has been a student and practitioner for a lot longer than me, or Ayurveda or Jyotish or any of the other vidyas, when you're around somebody who has a much more profound relationship to a particular vidya than you do, but you have a relation with that vidya, then during the period you're in that same general space as that other person and you're working with them, you will be able to perceive or do things that you can't do on your own otherwise, because the vidya is able to embody herself in you better by virtue of you being in a satsanga with that person who has done much more work than you have. So it's also just the fact that he had done so much more sadhana and he had so much more experience with that world that just being in his presence, just being in satsanga, allowed other people to perceive things, even temporarily, that they would never have been able to perceive on their own.
And so HOMA was a practice that he gave you to do.
Right? Yes.
And so how did that also play in?
Well, I mean, Fred here did his PhD dissertation on Agnihotra, which is a fancy way of saying the fancy version of Homa in the Vedas. Homa is a general kind of word. I mean, you will definitely find people who say they are performing Homa, and other people would say that's not Homa at all. I mean, India is full of different opinions about things. But his philosophy was that the fire is a living being. The fire offers you, just as the first phrase in the Rig Veda says, Agnim ile purohitam. So Agni is the purohita, is the priest. The fire itself is the priest that connects you to the next world, that transmits your offerings to the next world. So if you want to be connected to the next world, having a relationship with fire is really utilitarian, because that's the thing that is connecting you to the next world.
Yeah, and the whole verb there, ire, agnim ire purohitam, the verb is I adore, I love, I worship. It's all of that's connected up in that unusual Vedic verb. So there was a sense of connection like that. Let me get back to one other point about this. And that's when Dr. Robbie here just mentioned the word vidya and used a pronoun for vidya, she. Connected up with this vidya and with her. Note that. This is a kind of, exactly the kind of observation both of us have been talking about, that through observing Vimalananda's relationship with vidyas, with what we would simply call branches of knowledge, but these were manifestations. These were spirits in a way. These were living like a vidya, a branch of knowledge is not just a bunch of leafy old books on a floor, but these are living beings. This is the adidaivic way of seeing it, is seeing a branch of knowledge, a vidya, as a living being, and how it manifests, how it transmutes, how it's shaped, how it's formed. And Vimalananda was dropping these breadcrumbs, these clues constantly about that the entire universe was living, and they were living presences. And we might think about abstract entities that might just be nothings, just be pieces of floating debris out there. But for him, they were living beings, and that was kind of enculturating into us the sense of an adidaivic way of seeing the world. And there were a lot of things that could enhance that, including intoxicants, including Homa, and any sadhana is there in order to nourish within us the adidaivika perspective. That's the way I saw Vimalananda, but
I think that's a very efficient and detailed way of looking at that reality. And it really, I mean, the point is very much that he was always, whether you were aware of it or not, he was always providing a perspective that he hoped you would pick up on so that it would broaden your own perspective on reality. And for him, literally everything was, because, I mean, he embraced the Sankhya Darshana as much as many other people do, in fact, a lot more. So he would say that everything is, because everything is evolved out of consciousness, that everything is conscious. Maybe it's conscious in a tiny, you know, maybe it is not even aware that it is conscious, but there is consciousness in there somewhere.
Even a rock,
in a matchbox. He would hold up a matchbox and he would say, this matchbox is conscious. It's just, and if you regard it with respect, it is going to, and this is not, you know, this is not something original on his part. If you even look in the Ayurvedic texts, it says literally, if you behave properly with the food grains and the farm animals and the gemstones, they will behave properly with you. And if you don't, and he says this, you know, Vimalananda would say, this just is the basic hygiene when it comes to living. If you respect everything to the degree that those things are karmically going to be well aligned with you, they will be well aligned with you. And if you regard everything as being your possession and you can waste and destroy whatever you want to, that's what's going to happen in your direction. I mean, the golden rule, Jesus created the golden rule because it was a simple way of saying that whatever you do is coming back in your direction. It's not at all complicated. And so he was always respectful with everything, especially what he was going to eat. So, you know, he would pick up a cauliflower and I remember him one day saying to it, "Oh, Ma," you know, because everything That's was right. a mother to him. "Oh, Ma, I'm going to cut you now." And so, and then he chopped it up. But, you know, I could feel at that moment that he was really extending his compassion to the thing, appreciating that it had its own experience, its own reality, its own life, and that life was about to be terminated. But he appreciated what it was doing. It was being terminated, but it was keeping his own physical body alive, and he was blessing it. And then by virtue of doing that, then that blessing comes back to him. It's not like he was doing it for some utterly altruistic motive. It was to be nice to the cauliflower, but also to be nice to himself and whoever else was going to eat it. So it's just, and this is the sort of thing that is this so, you know, he made the point that this kind of attitude should be so basic to life that everybody does it, and then everything would be moving in a much more straightforward and easy or easier kind of, this is not an easy planet to live on, but an easier kind of matter. But people have unfortunate ideas about who they are and what the world is, and they create more and more complications for themselves and for everybody around them.
In fact, there was one exactly this very same thing. And I was in the Bombay apartment, and it was time to cook dinner. So he decided he wanted to cook a dish of lal bopla, or deep orange squash.
A pumpkin.
A large, massive Indian pumpkin. And I assiduously watched him do this. He held this up. He spoke to it. He recited a few mantras to himself, whatever. And he apologized, the Jai Ma, all of this. And then he made this dish, and I watched very carefully everything he did. And I have never been able to replicate what he did. And I have tried that dish, which was so delicious, at least 50 times. I've never been able to get it quite the way he did.
So you think it was the mantras?
I don't know. He had that magic about him in that kitchen. I really tried.
It's always hard to tell whether it was a mantra or just personal power or the fact that he had done it so many times that it was the dish itself was creating itself, or a combination of all of the above. I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to, causality. It's you know, single factor causality doesn't exist, and we try to find out what is the most important factor, when in fact sometimes there is no most important factor. In Ayurveda, we call it yukti, bahu karana yogaja, something that is created from many different causes.
Right.
So when all the causes come together, and after a while, you know, if you're doing this, it's just a matter of, you don't even have to make a lot of effort. You just kind of, you align yourself in a certain way, and things automatically happen. So, and that in itself is quite instructive.
Because he had such a really fluid sense of nature around him, like in the kitchen that evening. I think all of this, in his case, added up to a kind of elegance. There was something just deeply elegant about him, about the way he moved, about the way he spoke, about the way he performed Homa. There was just an elegance because he was so connected up in both a conceptual and a detailed way with his surroundings. I was at the racetrack with him once. I don't think Robbie was there, but it was in Pune. And he was dressed in his suit and all of that. And we were sitting in the owner's boxes. And there were all of these owners, and he would introduce me to, this is Mr. Chowdhury, who manufactured 5 crores of rupees in his basement last week, that kind of thing. And this is Mr. Poonawalla. This is different people, well-known horse people in the horse race world. And he was sitting there in his fine suit, and I was trying to be as, since I didn't even have a pair of shoes. And I just had my chuppels. And but I could see that there was a kind of an, he was greatly respected and admired and by all these owners whose wealth was way more than his, but who were really, really the top guns at the racetrack. And but his elegance was so profound that he was very much admired, and they all spoke very well about him. And it was just kind of a really satisfying situation to see that. Yeah.
There's an archaic Italian word that really applies to him. Sprezzatura. It's also a nice word to say. Sprezzatura. And it means effortless expertise. Effortless. So yeah. He never wasted even a moment attempting to put on a persona. It was always completely and utterly natural. In Sanskrit, we use a little bit of a longer word, sarva guna sampannata, which means in all of the qualities, there was sampannata, there was like a completion or a perfection or accomplishment or something. So it was just like everything, all of the qualities were just automatically displaying themselves to their best capabilities. And he was just there delivering, you know, whatever was needed to be delivered at that moment.
So both of you, I'm assuming, had moments where he would get angry at you because you said he had a temper. But did you always feel the love from him, even if he was angry at you?
Well, I did, at least.
It was always there. It was always the flow of love. And when he was angry with, I mean, sometimes you could see that he was put out by somebody, like he was with Dr. Panotra when he ran out of petrol. But around us, I think he was always, that flow was always there.
I wanted to talk to you all as well about Avishkara, which is in the Agora books. Were you both there at times when he was doing that at the same time? So what was your experience like, Fred? Because I think we've talked a little bit about it.
Well, he would get himself into a state. It was often slightly, you know, it wasn't like immediate, but it would take a few minutes for him to move into a condition.
There music, or just describe the scene a little bit for us?
No, there wouldn't often be music.
But, I mean, it would depend. Certain songs, would cause him to go in a certain direction.
Yeah.
Sometimes wearing a particular turban in a particular way, sometimes some fragrance. He had I don't know what you would call it, methods for to foment the inception of a particular state. And of course, his point was, it was prudent to have some kind of control over whether you were going into a certain state or not, because if you went into samadhi while you were driving down the road, that might not be good. So even though he was always moving from one level of reality to another, he always kept alignment with this reality so that he could continue to function in this reality when he needed to.
There were many times I remember him going into, as Robert mentioned here, about the turban or the incense. There was a, something sensory or physical that would place him. It, you know, it was a sense of elegance. It was his physical beauty and so on that would pull him into these different states. A song, a turban, some attar or incense. And he could sit there looking extremely regally. He was a regal persona under any circumstance, but you could even see his physical being appearance change. And it wasn't a matter of him hypnotizing you to believe that.
So it wasn't acting, that's clear. It's like
no, it wasn't acting, and it wasn't him just putting a spell on you to make you think that he was actually looking like Hanuman, or certain depictions of ancient emperors, that kind of thing. But it was that he really did, in my experience, actually change his physical form a bit. But it was very commanding. It was very generous. It was very straightforward. Some would often approach him when he was in such. His eyes would kind of very, very much change. And people would ask him things. They would ask him about their daughter's marriage or about, you know, sometimes people would ask him spiritual questions of a tantric variety, like about worshiping a certain deity or something like that. And he would answer them as, you know, but it was always kind of cryptic. Because he was on his level and everybody else was on their levels, and he would say what he was going to say, but he wasn't going to compromise and come down to a certain level just because that's what they wanted. But he could answer them straight away, and people came for healings. And that was a big thing people came for. They were suffering from something or other, and sometimes he would just, even in his condition, he would like grab them by the armpit or something like that and grab it like a tendon and pull it really hard. Did you ever see that?
Yes. Or, you know, he would hit somebody or occasionally he would kick someone.
Yeah.
And they'd feel better.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Sometimes dramatically.
Mm. Yeah. So, people would come around. That's the big thing, is that spiritual figures in India are expected to be miracle workers as far as healing is concerned. And he had that power, but he was also new enough when it was... Because this is the thing, what Robert was mentioning about Rinodabandhana, which is, you know, karmic debt, literally. A karmic balance, the balance of debt, and anubandhana, bondage. And he knew who was there, whose healing would not afflict him, and whose he had to take on because of his own karmic relationship with that individual. So people would come in and they would... And he wouldn't attend to them at all. And they would be bummed out and say, oh, he's nothing but a fraud because he didn't heal me, you know, as if I'm so important that I should be healed by him, you know? Mm-hmm. And, but then there were certain people whom he felt a stronger relationship with that he would take on, or he would help, or he would give clues, or he would give cues, or he would prescribe certain medications as often as not. In fact, more often than not, he would say, you take this or that or the other medication, the Ayurvedic or allopathic or homeopathic, whatever it was. If he would tell them to take it, it would usually work. You know, it wasn't, they didn't come into him in the last stages of cancer and say, give me a medicine. And he'll say, go home and take an aspirin. You know, he would know better than to do something like that. You know, because he was always measuring out Rinodabandhana. This was part of that adidaivic perspective, you know, of the immediacy of a situation, the immediate spiritual, psychic, physical, dyvic relationship. And that was, he did that in the healing.
And sometimes he would end up taking on things that yeah. people which happens to other people who are not even very spiritually advanced, sometimes without their knowing it. But and frequently it was the case that people could not even perceive that that he was doing things for them. Probably the most extreme example of this was when he actually died. There were three people present in the room: mm-hmm. me, Roshni, and a certain other lady. And just, I don't know. And this is somebody whose family that he had been working with and helping out in various ways for not that long, maybe a couple of years or something. And it was a couple of weeks after that that this woman came to me and Roshni and said, "Oh my God, he never did anything for us. And we put out so much money feeding him and paying to take him here and there." And both Roshni and I literally could not believe what we were hearing. So here's this person who had been experiencing all of this and had not been able to perceive it at all, had been present when he died, but still had been her ability to perceive had been completely blocked. So, I mean, there were, and such were also the, I mean, there were just, not very few people could really get an idea of what was going on with him. He did not want people to know what was happening. When he was younger, he said sometimes too many people would come, and then he would have to tell them that after a while he would say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I got involved with some woman and now I have lost all my power. Please go away." And they'd go away. And then after a while, more people would come. Then he'd have to come up with a new excuse somehow. So he never wanted people to come to him. They would come to him anyway. And sometimes he just sort of manipulated the situation that they would think, first they were thinking, "Oh, I should come in his direction." Then suddenly they, "Actually, there's nothing here. I'm going to go somewhere else." And off they would go.
I saw him get kind of wild on these foreigners who found him. I don't know how they found him in Pune. They were Rajneeshers, and they were living in the Kabristan, which is the Muslim cemetery. And they were looking just, I remember them coming into the room, and they were just looking terrible, unhealthy, debilitated, you know, with energy, like, lost. And, you know, you could say that there was a certain kinds of people who came to Pune as Rajneesh disciples back then in the early 80s. But these people were looking particularly down and out, and how they even found their way there, I got no idea. But he got really wild on them, and after asking where they lived, and they told him, then he said, "You know, you've got to get out of there right away. Don't even spend another minute there." And of course, they went back and spent more time there because that's where they were camping out. But eventually, I guess they did get scared enough to leave, because, believe it or not, they found their way back to him about 2 months later. And I was there, and they were looking a whole lot better. And they thanked him for telling them to leave the Kabristan. This is the thing, you hang out with dangerous...
A graveyard.
Yeah. Graveyard with certain kinds of unfriendly spirits. And it could have a debilitating effect on you. You have to really, you know, be careful about that. Yeah.
So, but he was not anti-foreigner, obviously. No. Fred and I were there. And I have not, there's a woman I have not met, but an Australian woman who he met maybe, I don't know, a decade or 15 years. And yeah, long before, and who he helped out and gave some guidance. But, understood that his relation with her was not such that he It was not the same relation that he might have had with me, for example. So, but she has continued. I mean, she still testifies to how much he helped her out back at that time. So it had nothing to do. I mean, he did, generally speaking, feel like there tended to be a big challenge being born in the West. And of course, now I'm talking about 50 years ago. So now it's a big challenge being born in the affluent world. And that is that you think you can buy things and you think that everything is about consumption and that love means sex. And all, and instead of really taking a close look at reality, and that's what he always, said repeatedly, always live with reality, because if you don't, you can be absolutely, reality is not going to pretend that everything is fine with you. Reality will come and live with you, and you're going to have to do it. Do it in advance before you have to do it.
Mm. Yeah, as you were talking, it reminded me of what you were saying earlier about what you give is what you get back, you know? And so when people are in the receptive mode or they're grateful, it seems like the healing comes back in their direction.
Definitely.
More so. And, you know, their ability to perceive this adidaivika, if they're open, if they're, you know, feeling positively towards that energy and being open towards it, it's going to come back towards them. So it's sort of like the same kind of concept with all the healing and the, you know, being receptive to that. And I'm curious, because I know a lot of your work has been around possession. And so what impact did it have for you to be in these spaces with Vimalananda to tap into that adidaivika? Like, how did that inform your academic work and what you did in the world?
Well, it really did inform it. In fact, I dedicated my book to him. And it made me just really aware that whether we know it or not, there's always these other forces around us, and it would behoove us to make friends with them to the best of our ability. And as Robbie was saying here, is that, you know, we're under the illusion that acquisitiveness is the goal of life, acquisition, and but stand back and breathe easy and let our senses relax into living with reality, into the reality. Reality is not just what we see in front of us. That's one thing, but we have to always be cognizant of that, of course. But there's a lot more that's there for us to be cognizant of, and that's... So he impacted my work so when I started really doing a lot of research on and hanging out with a lot of people who were possessed and possession rituals and people who'd been negatively possessed and had some affliction because of it, then I began to attune myself into that as well. Not to the point where I would ever dream of becoming a healer, nor did I have the skills, but at least I was able to understand some of the mechanics of the way that different levels of our visible and nearly visible worlds could organize themselves.
Do you want to share how being around Vimalananda now, thinking back, like how that impacted your, I mean, obviously it's impacted your life a lot, but do you want to share something?
I think the thing that, it's hard to come up with one thing, but I think the thing that comes up to me right at the moment is that he always liked to say that Tantra was the science of personality. People think they have one personality, actually they have several personalities, and none of them really most people have no control over which personality is activated at any one moment. It's all, they're just being manipulated by their karmas. And so the idea is to unify your personality and to progressively transform it into another personality. And so by when I was around him and he was in the flesh, automatically I could feel my own personality aligning with him. And there is to a certain degree, and often substantial degree being influenced by his. And since he has gone from being embodied to disembodied, I've continued to number one, feel his presence in my life, but sometimes to feel my own self sometimes embodying his energy or his way of and having to a minor degree, no doubt, but perceptibly to have his presence acting through me in some positive way in some environment in which positive action was required. So it's been interesting to see as time has gone by, and he passed away in December. It'll be 40 years this year. But it's been interesting to see how I have evolved. So it's been easier for me to act as a vehicle through which that his presence can have hopefully a beneficial effect in the world.
Yeah, well said, well said. You know, that's why our teachers are always acting through us. And if we try to prevent it, then we're just messing up what they're doing. We're messing up the teaching. But by welcoming that energy given to us by our teachers, it's a kind of a repayment, balancing out that run out of bandhana in a way. We're doing the best we can. It may not be whatever it was that was given to us, but we're doing what we can.
And he never claimed that he was noteworthy or important or
no,
anything.
No, never.
He always said, if I know anything, it is because of my gurus and because of Maas, Mashantara.
Right.
I'm just acting as the vehicle for those things. So acting as a vehicle for him is acting as a vehicle for his gurus and for his deities. And those gurus were acting as a vehicle for their gurus. And I was fortunate. In fact, both Fred and I were fortunate to know his Diksha Guru. He had three gurus. And one of them, Roshni met, but we did not. And one of them that in the Agora books is known as Junior Guru Maharaj, we met many times. And he was a very different person from Vimalananda. But it's obvious that there was that the reality of and that previous guru of Vimalananda's was also a guru of Junior Guru Maharaj. So there was a web of Runano Bandhana acting at a totally different level that was involved in facilitating certain forms of knowledge that have been transmitted from generation to generation to continue being transmitted. And what will happen now, we don't know, but at least there's the potential that some of that will be transmitted to some future generation.
Yeah, and every disciple gets a different quality of energy and teaching. I remember once sitting with Vimalananda in Bombay, and this sadhu comes in from the jungles dressed in black, all black, like a black dhoti, a black shirt, black uparna, a gamcha over his shoulder, like that, and looks very sort of tough and a little bit foreboding about him. And I asked Roshni later, who is this? And she said, oh, somebody that he taught to go out into the forest and perform some sadhana. So people like this that I never, you meet once, that were also represented him in a certain different kind of way than we did. And I don't know how many of these people were out there that I never met. You might have met more of them.
No. He said there were, you know, two or three people that he had initiated and sent out into the forest, and they were there and they were doing what they needed to do. But most people he would not send out into the forest, because he said most people have runana bandhanas that need to be dealt with here. And he said to me more than once, you know, I would love to send you out into the forest, but you have responsibilities in this world, and there's no use trying to run away from them, because they will just catch up with you. So deal with them in this lifetime, and let's see what happens next time.
In the same way, I expect the Guru Maharaj had many more disciples than we would ever have known about, and who would have been different characters, different personalities, different sets of karmas than Vimalananda. And this is the beauty of the Indian spiritual traditions, is that it does change from generation to generation. That the dynamism of all of these sampradayas or traditions lays in the fact that they're not replicated exactly from one generation to the next, but there's always some change going on, which is necessary because it's accounting for the thing that they don't account for in institutionalized religions, which is runana bandhana, which is a person's exact personality and the dynamic between teacher and disciple. They can account for this within some of these traditions like this. But so they're not just hammering some kind of Procrustean bed, hammering some doctrine into a person, you know? But there's a real, this is what keeping the traditions alive. Anyway, enough with that lecture.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Guru Maharaj was, Fred is one of the few people who have actually seen Guru Maharaj's certificate from the Archaeological Survey of India. And that said, that this is to certify that Jatal Sadhu Rambiswamar Das was found, it didn't say in Samadhi, it just said was found during an excavation in Kurda Road Taluka of Puri district of Orissa State in the year, was it
1904?
1904. And I mean, this is something that doesn't happen so much anymore, but we know has happened. There are many stories of sadhus who have been sitting for centuries in samadhi. Many people, including me, believe that Jnaneshwar Maharaj is still sitting in samadhi after more than 700 years in Alandi. And but just because he was in samadhi for 200 years does not mean his runana bandhanas have all gone away. He came out of samadhi, that Guru Maharaj came, you know, was found in the remains of this temple that had collapsed 200 years before. Somebody was brought from Puri, brought him down out of samadhi, and then he was back in the stream of runana bandhana. So the reality of what it means to be partly in the spiritual world and partly in this world is, I mean, it's such a particular reality that, as Fred says, it's, you know, modern simplified versions of spirituality just do it are not at all representative of what that reality actually is. I read a book just a few days ago about a man known as Baba Bhagwan Das Bodhisattva, who had an ashram in the 1960s in Matunga, which is a section of Bombay. He apparently was from the Punjab somewhere, or maybe Sindh, West Pakistan, supposedly. He'd come and ended up in Bombay. And he was the guru of Dr. Ramamurti Mishra, later known as Brahmananda Saraswati, who founded Ananda Ashram in Monroe, New York. And one of the things at the very end of the book that that Dr. Mishra, I knew him. I met him several times. He had not taken sannyas at that time. He was still known as Dr. Mishra. And so one of the things that Dr. Mishra says at the end of this book that I think that is really, 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 it encapsulates this in a certain way, is that God is omnipresent. God is everywhere. Call it God or providence or whatever you want to. And we human beings are not. We're very particular. But what we can do that God can't do is be particular and cosmic at the same time. And that's why the universe exists, so that we can go beyond what God is capable of. Now, of course, going what beyond is God is capable of, you know, if you are able to do one good thing, there's always going to be some kind of cost for it. There's no free barbecue. So when Rama or Krishna or Parashurama or anybody gets born into the world, they have to deal with karmas also. They have problems that they have to deal with. But they're dealing with them at the same time that they are connected into the cosmic reality of something that is beyond all manifestation. So it's the very fact of being able to exist and connect to that reality on this plane is something that is in that way superior to simply being disconnected from all manifestation. And so the basis of Indian spirituality for the past many thousands of years has been, we have the one and we have the many, and the one and the many are relating to one another. They have an ongoing relationship, and it can't possibly have started, because that would imply that time existed before creation. And what will happen in the future, we don't know. But definitely what's happening right now is that this is still part of that same relationship between unity and diversity that's been happening for so long. And Vimalananda was a unique, like all of us are, but he was a uniquely unique manifestation of this, of the drama. And the comedy, the pathos, the tragedy, the comedy, the full spectrum of what it means to exist at the, as Alfred Jarry used to say, God is the tangential point between zero and infinity. To exist at that tangential point between where there is the singularity and where there is the infinitude, and just to be walking along that tangential
razor's edge,
the razor's edge. And he liked to say often in Hindi, "Na zindagi ki khushi, na maut ki gham, kinare kinare chale hum," meaning, I'm not connected to or attracted by the pleasures that life has to offer. I'm not dismayed by the misery of death. I'm walking along, right along the edge. And that's what he did.
Yeah, he really embodied the one and the many. But to him, the one was very alive and in its own kind of embodiment. You could say smashantara, or you could say whatever you want. But the many was many more than we would think on all kinds of different levels. So he was able to kind of patch it all together and be kind of a channel for the one and the many. At least he was for those people who were attuned to him. Yeah.
Well, thank you both for your time.
With pleasure.
Yes, definitely. I enjoyed it. And thank you for bringing us together for this.
Om Namah Shivaya.
Om Namah Shivaya.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.